everyone. This is Maya welcoming you to today's sixth live podcast organized by the Berkeley Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies. Join us for virtual gatherings to keep up to date with topics related to Israel and to Jewish law, thought, and identity. In today's episode, we'll discuss the rule of law under extreme conditions as it applies to the current crisis in Israel. We're joined by Amnon Reichman, Professor of Law, University of Haifa, and a recent Robbins Collection Visiting Professor of Comparative Law. Amnon is also a principal investigator at the Minerva Center for the Study of Law Under Extreme Conditions. And we're very lucky that Amnon will be joined today in conversation by the Institute's co-faculty director, Professor Ken Bamberger. Ken is the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation Professor of Law at Berkeley Law School and also the co-director of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology.
Amnon, what an opportunity to be in conversation with you in this scary and uncertain time. You've been running a center that focuses on the ways that law adapts to, responds to, changes in light of extreme conditions. What does that mean? What are extreme conditions?
Yes, it's an honor to be here. I wish we could do it in person, but that's another way of being in person. It's a novel way of being in person, a virtual person. So the rule of law under extreme condition looks at this very question of what happens to law when the very fabric of society that is presupposed by law is threatened. And by that we mean that there's a sense that law organizes society in a certain fundamental way. But sometimes, either because of natural disasters, what we call natural disasters, that are, of course, there is a man-made component there, war or socioeconomic meltdowns, society no longer functions the way law presupposes. And then the question is, what happens to law? Is law part of the solution or is law part of the problem? And that's an aspect of what we're looking at in the Minerva Center.
What are some of the other ways you assess on whether law is a problem or solution? You're sitting right now in Israel. What are some of the ways on the ground? We spoke last week in a previous podcast about where things were. What are the facts on the ground in Israel today in terms of the legal response?
Okay, so in order to understand that, we have to first think about what do we mean by the facts on the ground, which facts are relevant. And in order to understand that, we have to first realize that extreme conditions, what extreme conditions do is that they challenge the very basic presumptions that we have in the following three ways. Number one, usually, at least in democracies, we cherish checks and balances. We like the notion that no one branch has full or complete power. However, in an extreme condition, this is exactly what we think we need. That is, we need a quick response. We need a coordinated response. All the checks and those checks and balances may appear to us to be a distraction, may appear to us to be just a hindrance to our efforts. That ties to the second dimension. That's the dimension of rights. The whole point of rights is that we tell the state, hey, you cannot sacrifice the individual in order to promote the general welfare. Democracy is about individual rights, and we're going to block you, usually through judicial review, we're going to block you, the majority, from harming, infringing on individual rights or minority rights, even though you think what you're doing is for the best of the nation, because rights are important. And here, under extreme conditions, this is what we often do. As we see now on the grounds, we tell people, sorry, we have to infringe on your rights in order to protect the many. And that's really challenging. And the last component here is this notion of whether we want to act with full knowledge of the facts, that is in a very calm, collected way. We usually expect democracies to have all the facts before the decision makers, not to rush into decisions, to have professional mechanisms that calculate and assess all the facts.
And we want to do it with professional assistance, and we have separation of powers, as I said before. And in emergency, sometimes you have to act on an insufficient knowledge. That's the nature of the extreme condition. And you cannot prepare for that, right? You cannot have a full, you can try to prepare, but you cannot have a fully prepared outline for how to deal with those extreme conditions. And the reason I'm outlining those three dimensions is precisely is what
we see on the ground now in Israel. We see...
But before you go in, let me just recount. Basically, you've identified three different ways that government power is constrained, that government power is channeled, that we make sure that government power is fair, right? So first of all, separations, checks and balances. It's not all invested in a single branch of the government, but there are other branches competing for power. Second, we say rights. We say you can't act using the power that you want all the time because there are limits on your power, and those limits are my rights. And the third is kind of process. You can't act as quickly as you want to. You need to slow down. You need facts. You need expertise. You need input. You need deliberation. So we have these three elements of good governance, making sure that government can act, but not with too much power, right? And I'm hearing from you that the challenge in extreme conditions is that there's sand thrown in the wheels of all of these. You were about to talk about the Israeli context.
Right.
You want to start with separation of powers, checks and balances.
Right.
What's been the problem there?
So the exactly as you were saying, there is sand thrown into it because we expect the state, we need the state, we need the collective power of the state to address a disaster. But the challenge then becomes, how do you balance? Because you don't want to give up on all those three main characteristics of democracy. You don't want just to have a Roman dictatorship by which you just grant full power and you say, okay, let's meet at 6 o'clock after the war is over, and then we'll revisit the notion of democracy. No, you want to still hang on to those precepts, but they're stressed. And what's happening on Israel right now in terms of separation of powers is the following. There are two interesting and challenging developments. The one is that the state, the government, the Israeli government is empowered by the Basic Law to issue emergency legislation, emergency regulation. This regulation has the power to suspend primary legislation. This is as if in the United States, it is as if a secretary or an agency would issue rules and regulation that would suspend the enabling statute. That is radical. That is something that you don't expect. And the idea here is that you need, again, quick response. You need coordinated response by the government. And you can't wait for the usual processes of the Knesset to kick in. And we've had that. The last time we had this in Israel was 1973 during the Yom Kippur War. And that was a really rare exception in those circumstances, right? There was one other or a couple of other uses of emergency legislation, but it was against strikes. So that was an odd use of the legal tool. But the last time it was used for emergencies was actually during the Yom Kippur War, following the Yom Kippur War. So this is a rather major event. That's with respect to separation of powers. Then the question immediately brings itself forward, and that is, so what is the role of parliament? What is the role of the Knesset when the government uses those emergency regulations? This brings me to the second.
And how do you even, how can you even balance it? What's the framework that you use to think about? It is an emergency.
Right.
People are dying. Unless there's community action taken, the entire community will be affected and portions wiped out, right? Hungary's response this week was the parliament created a president for life and suspended the constitution, right? They created an authoritarian dictatorship and they said, we need the power centralized in one position. Obviously, that's not the only solution, hopefully.
Right.
How do you justify slowing down the process with these limits and say, you know, do we need to pretend that everything's normal? Obviously, Israel is good at ramping up in emergencies. Right. How do you ramp up while at the same time retaining some piece of these structural elements that say slow down?
Right. So this is where parliament becomes really, really important. So the British counterexample to the Hungarian example is that in Britain, in the United Kingdom, they just passed a regular legislation. They can do that relatively quickly in the United Kingdom. This is how they do it. They pass a statute that is a statute that deals with a particular emergency. It's ordinary statute. It doesn't give necessarily the government emergency powers to suspend laws. But in Israel, the idea is that you provide the government with extra powers, but you insist that the parliamentary committee, that the Knesset committee will review the matter, will make sure that the government does have at least sufficient basis, that the government is also aware of the costs, that the government has made a balance that is reasonable under the circumstances, and it also limits the statutes, the basic law limits the duration of the emergency measures, and then they have to be renewed by the Knesset. So the Knesset's presence there is built in, is baked into the design. However, and that brings me to the second point, we, up until recently, and you talked about it last week, we didn't have an operating Knesset. It was a really rare situation where you have a caretaker government, a government that hasn't won the confidence of the Knesset yet, and the Knesset itself wasn't functioning. The Speaker of the Knesset used some delay tactics, and then the one party that won a majority in a potential coalition started to proceed within the Knesset to set up the committees, and that was met with resistance. So there was a whole maneuvering that was going on inside the Knesset, and then you had to go to court. In a really rare move, you had to go to court to force the Speaker to hold election for the Speaker of the Knesset. And the whole point was in order to make sure that the Knesset is present. You'll talk next week, and that's a teaser for next week. You'll talk next week about privacy and the emergency regulation that dealt with privacy. And a very important component there, and that's just a generic statement, was the ability to access the relevant committee, the relevant parliamentary committee that could supervise this.
So parliamentary supervision. How about individuals, right? They don't have the structural power of the parliament. Their rights are supposed to be protected elsewhere, but in Israel now, you can't move more than 100 meters from your home. There are military in the streets, corralling people up, giving them fines, giving them tickets, threatening arrest. How do we make sure at a time that everybody is focused on stopping this emergency, that individual rights are preserved? First of all, should we care about those rights? At what point should we care? Do those rights become more important or less important? And what's even the mechanism for anyone to focus on those rights if mostly we're worried about staying alive and eating and living?
Right. So this is exactly where your commitment to the underlying principles of a liberal democracy should shine, to the extent that they're there. And you're absolutely right. The challenge is real. This is not some theoretical law professor question that you can ask in an exam. This is we're experiencing right here now. So with respect to the two very important points here, one is you mentioned the military. So under Israeli law, the military is not authorized to actually exercise enforcement power at the moment. There has to be another empowerment that can kick in, may kick in order to empower the military to actually use police power. The military there is there, so they're not there with guns and they don't corral people. It's the police that do that, but it's still, the police can do that. And that brings me to the second point, and that is that under the basic law structure, you cannot suspend access to courts. Due process becomes crucial, even more crucial than under ordinary times. Due process becomes crucial. And this is the time where courts, where you really need courts. And here, you know, the pressure on courts is huge. As you just mentioned, the courts, the judges say, I don't want to, the initial reaction is in real time, I don't want to interfere with what the government is doing. They know better. It's a huge challenge. I don't want to put the brakes I usually do, or I may sometimes engage with under ordinary times, but this is emergency times. I should give greater deference. However, exactly like you said, if you care about rights, the risk to rights is now. The risk to overreact, the risk to suspend rights more than is necessary, too much, in a disproportionate manner, the way we call it in the rest of the world, other than in the United States, is greater now. And here we've seen some action in courts.
Yeah, how are the courts doing?
So we've seen some action in court. The court was very decisive in the procedural plane that you mentioned before, and that is setting up the Knesset. So the court reacted really strongly against the Speaker of the Knesset and said, you must hold elections because we have to get the government up and running. We have to get the parliament, the Knesset, up and running. And the court issued an injunction against the Speaker of the House, which is the Speaker of the Knesset, which is a really rare move.
He ignored it, am I right?
He ignored it, but then the court, he ignored it and resigned. And then the parties actually went back to court and said, what do we do now when he ignored it? And the court crafted, with the consent of the counselor of the Knesset, of the attorney of the Knesset, the court crafted this really extraordinary remedy by which the court told the Knesset what's going to happen, and the Knesset followed it. Even though the Speaker resigned and didn't follow up, the court said, what's going to happen now that the Speaker resigned, and basically set up the mechanism that is in place now.
So you feel like a constitutional crisis avoided?
We were at the brink.
Of the courts to deal in this context, yeah. Vindicated?
Yeah, so we're at the brink of a constitutional crisis, and it's unclear. Personally, I think that the court could have sent back the issue to the Knesset to say, look, your Speaker disobeyed. You deal with it. You're the Knesset. You can deal with it. Here, the list of options you can choose from. This is not what the court did. The court, at the request of the attorney of the Knesset, said, okay, this is what you got to do. So there are some debates whether the court could have been slightly less forceful. But what the court saw is exactly what you're saying, was a brink of a constitutional disarray, exactly where you cannot afford a constitutional disarray. We have to remind ourselves that we have an indicted prime minister. There are notions of, you know, whether the powers of the Knesset are used for the benefit of the Israeli population, or there's some other political maneuvering going on, and the court said, I'm not taking any chance. So in that respect, the court was very present. On the other hand,
yeah,
we've seen the court very deferential. I'll give an example. There was a petition by elderly people who had to be evacuated from their elderly house that's owned by the state.
The nursing homes,
yeah. Because the state said, we need those 60 beds or something, even though it appears that the state still has thousands of empty hotel rooms that they're not using yet. And the people, the elderly people who are disabled, most of them are disabled, they're incapacitated. They said, look, what's your basis in evidence? Why do you need to start with us now? Why can't you wait? We're going to suffer if we're just literally kicked out without an alternative. And the court said, well, that's a government prerogative. They can do it. We're not going to interfere. So that's a mixed bag in terms of how the court dealt with it thus far.
And any other credible claims you know of that are making their way up in the courts?
So you're going to talk about a key claim that was made with respect to privacy next week. That was a very important point where the court did intervene in order to protect the right of privacy. You're going to expand on that next week.
You can give us a little.
So the Knesset. Yeah. So the government used emergency legislation to empower the General Security Services to use tracking devices that can track down people who were confirmed as positive with the virus, and then track down all the people that were around them just by using their cell phones. And there was a petition to the Supreme Court against that, saying that it's a breach of privacy and it should be done at least with the supervision of the Knesset, and the court accepted this. As it turned out, and again, I don't want to get more into the details because you'll have a chance to talk about it next week. As it turns out, when the General Security Service tracks down people, the device it uses also tracks down all their phone calls, mm-hmm. a lot of metadata on them, just because this is a device. The device just tracked down everything on those people. So there's a question of proportionality and access, in excess. This is a problem that too many things are being surveilled by the state. And also, you couldn't challenge this. So you were told by this, you got an SMS saying, a text message saying, okay, you have to self-quarantine. And then you can say, but that's wrong, because there was a wall of 3 feet between us, and there was, you know, you couldn't talk to anybody. Go talk to the machine. The machine told you that you have to, the algorithm told you you have to quarantine, and that's it. So there are some due process issues there, but you're going to have a chance to talk about
it. And the court's response?
That hasn't been further litigated. The court just sent it back to the to Parliament, and it remains to be seen yet how this is going to work itself out. I think that the notion of social and economic rights, this is how you care for the right of, in Israel, you have positive rights for housing and healthcare and education, and that's, you know, that's going to come up. I think that's going to come up in courts as the situation unfolds further.
So you've pointed to two key institutional elements, parliament and courts, Knesset and court. You also mentioned the tremendous economic burden and economic devastation that this pandemic is bringing, not just to Israel, but the whole world. Without needing to rely on courts, which will be a long process, and as you've suggested, maybe a process of sending things back and reconsidering things, and court's potential hesitation. Is there an inclination that the Knesset is going to play this oversight and defensive role in terms of really vindicating individuals' economic rights in Israel and economic well-being?
So that's the major key people expect the Knesset now to undertake when the Knesset reconvenes, whatever the government ends up being. And again, politically speaking, the whole rationale of the breakup of the Blue and White Party was that the leader of the Blue and White Party, Benny Gantz, said, look, now is the time for the democratic process to kick in and care about how do we get back after we contain the outbreak? How do we protect the rights of those who are unemployed, those who rely on the healthcare system? And now the healthcare system has basically been hijacked in a way to just deal with the corona. And what about everybody else? So you will need parliament. So parliament set up a special committee called the Corona Committee in parliament, in the Knesset, to deal with those issues. And it is expected that this will be an undertaking for at least 6 months now. And again, I want to say that for this to work, there has to be active channels of participation beyond elections. So one key element, it goes back to the relationship between democracy and extreme conditions. What you apply pressure on the political process in Israel and elsewhere as well through demonstrations. However, how do you demonstrate when you're under a sort of a curfew or a shelter in, or whatever you want to call it, a lockdown? So the under Israeli basic law, it would be really difficult to justify emergency regulation that forbid demonstration altogether. And in fact, there is an exemption from demonstrations. There were demonstrations going to the Knesset with respect to the speaker's decision not to convene the Knesset to have elections for the speakership. And then there were demonstrations to the Knesset with respect to exactly what you were saying, with respect to the social and economic dimension of the crisis, the police tried to block those demonstrations. There were cars driving to Jerusalem, and the police, we have to understand that under extreme conditions, there is a risk of the stability of the regime itself. So police, one of the basic functions of police is actually to protect the regime. And here the police saw a large number of cars driving to Jerusalem with black flags, and the police got scared. What do they want to do? We didn't know anything about that. What's happened? So they started to give fines to the people in order to get them not to demonstrate. And then there was an intervention by the counselor of the police, saying, you got to allow them to demonstrate. This is a key element of democracy, even under extreme conditions. And we anticipate this to go on now, just today. However, the CEO of the health ministry issued another regulation or rule saying you cannot demonstrate more than 10 people. That may
the health minister, of course, having just been diagnosed positive with COVID-19. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And we expect that if this is going to be enforced, it's unlikely that the court will uphold the idea that you can only demonstrate, only 10 people could demonstrate. And again, they might say, okay, you can demonstrate with cars, or you can demonstrate in 2 meters apart or something like mm-hmm. that. Precisely because, as you were saying, the parliamentary process is viable to the extent there's also an ability for political protest.
This makes me think of a related question in the importance of democracy in protecting minority rights, minority communities, smaller groups, divergent points of view. One way, of course, is to permit demonstrations, which are not necessarily representing a minority, but a minority of people who will come out and demonstrate. Right. But we've seen various tensions in the last week between certain groups within Israel who are not inclined to follow the shelter-in-place emergency regulations, and in fact are with their bodies and with their voices pushing back against that, primarily in the Haredi community, in the ultra-Orthodox community. Where does that fit into the discussion of law under extreme conditions?
So that's a very interesting point. So one of the key characteristics of Israel as a Jewish democracy is this notion of, I wouldn't call it multiculturalism because that's stretching it a bit, but the idea that the importance of group rights, so the fabric of society is really multi-layered. It's an interesting fabric, and the Haredi community, which is a very important and vibrant part of the Israeli society, always maintained a degree of autonomy within the general framework, and it was respected in a lot of ways. The general framework is again the framework of cultural rights. You want to protect your culture, your own culture, your own minority culture, against the pressures of assimilation from the outside or from the majority culture. Now there's a clash because in emergencies, especially in pandemics, the question of what does it mean to maintain your culture. Initially, the rabbis or some key rabbis said, no, you got to keep going to the synagogue to pray. Why? Because God will save us. That's the whole point of religion. You got to pray, because if you don't pray, we're going to suffer. And you gotta trust us. We are the rabbis. You know, we have to. That's our obligation to safeguard religion under those times. Some members of the Haredi community kept doing this, even though the regulations were rather strict. Don't gather in prayer houses. The police didn't enforce this because the police didn't want to clash with the Haredi community. And now we know that the rate, for example, of COVID positive infections in Bnei Brak, which is a very condensed Haredi town, are more than triple or more than quadruple than other places in Israel. And just today, the government issued sort of a a new rule that says that this area is under a semi blockade, in the sense that you can't get in and out unless you have a very good reason. I think the Haredi community, it's a complicated decision. I think the rabbis now understand, or at least some of them, most of them now understand how severe the situation is. It took them some time to do that. But also, it ties into this notion of central and local government, because the Haredi community also tends to live in very tight quarters. The question is, what do you do? Suppose one person is COVID positive. The local authorities, the municipal, have to have powers to get this person out of the community into some hotel that are now, all the hotels are of course empty, to get them isolated, because if you tell them to shelter in their houses, you just infected the whole house. And because of the proximity of the way people live, it's impractical. However, legally speaking, they don't have the authority to do that, because that's only central government.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to having you back when we're trying to figure out how to unwind this, because it sounds like so many of the questions about how Israel takes its various commitments to group rights, to divided government, to emergency preparedness, it'll be interesting to see whether any changes are wrought in them. Before we go to Q&A, I'll ask you, you set forth three different components of democratic success in the face of extreme conditions: parliamentary involvement and oversight, individual rights, and
separation of powers.
And separation of powers. What grade would you give Israel at this moment?
I think, again, Israel...
I need a grade, A, B, C, D.
I'd say B to C, and that's partly because the initial reaction, everything is clouded with the fact that we have a constitutional crisis with respect to an indictment of the president and the caretakership. The government is not a regular government, not an elected government. So that meant that a lot of the built-in mechanisms we have in Israel we're running less smoothly this time, because we have some experience with wars. However, again, comparatively speaking, I think we're still doing okay. We're under stress, but we're holding on. We're holding on.